So I think I better make a start. So in spite of the fact that I'm sure all of you are dying to talk about Prince Harry's new book, this talk isn't about that at all. It's about cryptocurrencies and NFTs, favourite subject of nerds everywhere. This talk is not intended to be about making any kind of case for socialism. If there were any sort of actual visitors here, that might be a bit unfortunate. But people are emailing me saying they can't get in when they've already got in. Sorry, I meant to do several things at once here. It's not about making a case for socialism, because most of you don't need that. It's more of just a clarification for members about a subject area that, you know, quite a lot of people aren't too familiar with. You know, and there's been a gold rush in the last couple of years. Now, everybody knows what a gold rush is and what a speculator bubble is. But in the past, in history, nobody ever asked, what is gold exactly? Or, what is a tulip? But crypto is different. Because people don't really understand what it is. Now, capitalism is a society of multiple currents, all moving at different speeds, with technology being one of the fastest, and I suppose public understanding, and particularly the legislature, being among the slowest. And when last year, 2022, the crypto shit hit the fan, many people still didn't know what crypto was, or that there was even a fan. So I'm going to start off with where we are right now and what's just happened. And then I'm going to backtrack to how this all started before concluding with a few remarks about the future. Now, for those people who are who read the Socialist Standard, the January Pathfinders column does cover some of this material, so I'll try not to repeat anything that's there, although there's going to be a bit of overlap, obviously. So you've probably heard news stories in the past few weeks about the FTX crypto exchange collapse and the subsequent arrest of its owner, Sam Bankman-Fried, I think it's Fried, not Fried, in the Bahamas for prosecution in the US. Now, the first thing to ask is, what is a crypto exchange? Well, as I understand it, it's basically a bank that accepts cryptocurrencies, which, you know, high street banks don't. But unlike a real bank, as it were, it doesn't have any state regulation. So suppose you want to invest in some new and upcoming cryptocurrency, thinking it's going to increase in value. So you buy, let's say, £10,000 worth of my brand newly minted bollocks coin, which I'm busily hiring influencers to tout around as the next big thing. And sure enough, you see the value swiftly rocket to £50,000 as more and more investors get in on the act. Then it goes to £100,000. Then it goes to the moon while you enjoy the wild ride. But hold on a minute, you're not an idiot. You know that values don't keep rising forever and they are likely to drop. What you need is to cash out into something stable that won't fall. High street banks, as I said, won't accept your bollocks coin. What you need is a safe equivalent currency, a stable coin, in fact, as offered by a reliable crypto exchange. Like, for example, the $40 billion South Korean Terra Luna exchange, where Terra, as in Earth, not as in wild-eyed fear, was the exchange's own stablecoin, and Luna was the tradable volatile crypto token, named Luna because in crypto jargon it was expected to go to the moon. In May last year, the Terra stablecoin did the unthinkable and crashed. This brought down values across the world in crypto land by two-thirds. That's around $2 trillion wiped off global crypto values. It wiped off values across the board, across all 16,000. It's hard to believe there are 16,000, but there are cryptocurrencies. But not to worry. If you can't trust Terra Luna, you can definitely trust FTX, another reliable exchange worth $32 billion. So you cash your bollocks coin into FTT. This is the stable coin offered by the FTX exchange. Now, if bollocks coin hits the skids, you know your money's safe. It's safe because FTX is a safe money haven with a safe stable coin, FTT. And you know FTX is safe because Sam Bankman-Fried became a billionaire by the age of 30 and has hired celebrities to tell you how great FTX is. And he's even paid $130 million to rename Miami's sports stadium the FTX Stadium. So, basically, it's too big to fail. It's so great that it's the second biggest exchange in the world and such a prize that the first biggest exchange, Binance, wants to buy it. But then an article appears on the CoinDesk crypto news site revealing that Sam Bankman-Fried has been borrowing billions using his own stablecoin FTT as collateral. Now, remember, this is a made-up coin, and he's using it as collateral to borrow billions from other people. If you wanted to borrow money from the bank, you would need to use bricks and mortar property like your house. But Sam Bankman-Fried was using a made-up coin. Okay, not only that, he was lending large amounts of user deposits to a crypto hedge fund called Alameda Research. So user deposits is the money that you put into his crypto exchange. He's then lending that out in vast amounts to a hedge fund called Alameda Research. The article further reveals that the owner of Alameda Research is none other than Sam Bankman-Fried. So he's basically been lending vast amounts of your money to himself. Dodgy or what? Real banks, which have internationally enforced regulations, can't get away with this sort of thing, but in the crypto Wild West, anything goes. Now, following this article, Binance, that exchange that wanted to buy FTX, takes fright and announces it's going to sell $500 million worth of FTTs, the stable coin tokens of FTX. You're still following with me, good. The price of FTT tokens drops and an investor panic ensues. Withdrawal requests reach $6 billion in 72 hours, forcing FTX to halt withdrawals. Now Binance backs out of the purchase deal, leaving FTX basically with no choice but to file for bankruptcy. An SBF, as he's called, Sam Bankman-Fried, decamps to the Bahamas, which turns out to be not a very good business move by him because it has an extradition treaty with the US. Meanwhile, Do Kwon, the former CEO of the failed Terra Luna exchange, is reported to be hiding out in Serbia after Interpol issued an international red notice arrest warrant for him in September. Serbia does not have an extradition treaty with South Korea. Okay, so this all happened in November and December, just a month or so ago. So now you're all caught up with the hot crypto news and you're up to date. But I think it's time to get a bit of context here. So as you know, 2022 has been a bit of a financial meltdown all round. What with the fallout from a global pandemic, worker shortages, global supply chain problems, rising food prices and rocketing energy prices due to the war in Ukraine. But it's also hit the golden boys of the tech industry like they've never been hit before. With all the customer-facing tech firms, that's firms dealing with social media, streaming services, that kind of thing, as opposed to chip manufacturers and, you know, web storage services. All these have been massively hits. Apple, Microsoft, Google are all down by 30 to 40% on average. That 2 years ago, that would have been unheard of. Facebook, or Meta, as it's rebranded itself, has dropped 70% of its share price. And it's not just virtual commodities that have seen a crash either. Tesla has had a huge crash. At the start of 2021, it was valued at $1.2 trillion. It was on its way to becoming, as Elon Musk predicted, the most valuable company in the world. And at $1.2 trillion, it's worth approximately the value of all other car-making companies combined. But since then, it's fallen by 75% to about $350 billion. That's 75%. It dropped $50 billion in 1 day. $50 billion is equivalent to the value of the Ford Motor Company. It did that just a couple of weeks ago. Elon Musk's recent anti-Midas antics with Twitter, you know, anti-Midas, where everything he touches turns to shit, that must have knocked off a lot of his shine, with, you know, investors thinking he was spending too much time destroying Twitter and not enough time on making cars. But that's only part of the story, because the bigger picture is that the cheap money era is over. And investor optimism, you know, the sort of mañana optimism, has collapsed, with most tech firms that tend to be big on promises and short on immediate payouts now being seen as hugely overvalued. So that's what this was really about. It's not that they've lost money or they've underperformed or that they've just somehow it's been a run on the share price. It was just that they were seen as overvalued all along. And investors who at one point didn't mind waiting years for promised dividends because, you know, it was cheap money and low interest rates prevailed, so there was nothing better to invest in, they're now finding suddenly convincing reasons to pull their money out fast. And this is continuing almost as we speak. The crypto fallout's continuing in through January. The Financial Times reported on the 8th of January that US bank Silvergate has lost 40% of its share price after customers pulled $8 billion out. Now, this is significant because whereas the crypto crashes have been hitting what's called crypto native firms, that's just firms that only deal with crypto, Silvergate is a bank that also deals with crypto, apart as well as it were, real money. Another lender, Genesis, has had to lay off 30% of its staff, and the New York Attorney General is busily suing Celsius, another crypto bank. BlockFi, Three Arrows, Capital and Celsius all went bankrupt last year, as well as FTX and Alameda and, of course, Terra Luna. And basically, there's a huge scare. Clients have got scared of crypto and they're pulling their money out all across the board, and crypto firms are going bust. Meanwhile, regulators are ramping up the scrutiny of crypto lenders and exchanges because of how many people have lost money. It's estimated that 1 million people lost money in the FTX crash. Okay, so that's state of the art. Where did it all start? Though I think it's a good idea to, before we go any further, I ought to sort of recap how we got to this point, kind of starting with the basics, partly because not everybody necessarily knows this, partly because I think it's kind of interesting. So if you'll forgive me, a little bit of a historical digression. The crypto story itself really gets going in 2008. But even that builds on antecedents going back, well, I suppose, to the dawn of history, involving codes and ciphers. As you no doubt appreciate, the desire to send secret messages is as old as civilization, and basic codes and ciphers have been around since, well, at least the ancient Egyptians. Now, a basic cipher might be to, say, shift every letter one space to the left so that A becomes B, B becomes C, and so on and so forth. But, of course, these are very easy to decode. Technology has been applied to create ever more complex ciphers, if you remember the Enigma codes of World War II. But, you know, they were eventually cracked. And the state of the art now is what's called public-private key with PGP encryption. And I'm going to tell you what that is, whether you want to know or not, because I think it's interesting. And if anybody here knows more about this than I do, you can tell us afterwards. Now, so I'll just explain how I understand it. So, suppose you want to send a secret message to your friend across the town. Well, an envelope could be opened and a phone call intercepted. So you write the message on a note, you put the note in a locked box, and you send the box to your friend. But now you have the problem of sending the key to your friend, because without the key, your friend can't read the message. But if you send the key, it could be intercepted and copied. How do you get your friend to have a unique key that only they can have without first having to send it across a public, vulnerable space? So, all right, let's try that again. You want to send a secret message to your friend across town. So, you call your friend by open phone line and ask her to send you an open box with a lock that only she has the key for. She sends this box to you. It doesn't matter who sees the box at this point, as there's nothing in it and there's no key with it. You write your message, you put it in the box and lock it. It's a snapshot type lock. Okay, once you've locked it, you can't open it again because you don't have the key and neither does any malicious third party. Then you post this locked box back to your friend. Only she can open this box because only she has the private key for it. Perfect. That, in essence, is public-private key encryption. Now, theoretically, a lock picker might eventually figure out how to pick the lock on the box. But now we come to PGP and hash functions. At this moment, I'd like to switch analogies, if you can cope with that. I'd like to think of an encryption as being like a vast maze with an infinite number of routes. Whatever route you used to get into the maze, someone else could retrace to get back out. What a hash function does is give you a way in that can't be traced back out. This is so-called one-way encryption. The route can be figured out eventually by raw massive number crunching, but PGP technology means it would take the world's combined computers several years to do this, by which time your message is out of date and redundant. So this is what's known as PGP encryption. PGP, by the way, is not some scientific technical term. It simply stands for pretty good privacy. Now, if you agree with me that that's all absolutely fascinating, and that means that you are a hopeless nerd, and I strongly recommend that you read Simon Singh's fascinating book, The Code Book, that he wrote in 1999. But it's still up to date. Now, the crypto world, you're wondering when I was going to get to the point, the crypto world could not exist without PGP and hash functions. And one other key concept, which I'll just mention, which is P2P or peer-to-peer. This is a distributed computer network that doesn't have a central server like the earlier client-server model, which operated a bit like satellite planets going around a sun. If anybody remembers the first pirate site, Napster, it was eventually stopped after authorities closed down its central server. No such luck with P2P systems. That would be like playing whack-a-mole. As fast as you close individual nodes down, others pop up. Now, P2P is the basis of the secure ledger system known as the blockchain. This was first theorized in 1982 in a dissertation entitled computer systems established, maintained, and trusted by mutually suspicious groups, or blockchain for short. I'm very tempted to digress into the interesting story of the mysterious Satoshi Nakamoto, who may be one of the world's richest people, but who alternatively may not actually exist at all. Satoshi Nakamoto is the name used by the anonymous person or persons who, in 2008, invented a decentralized, time-stamped blockchain system which introduced a difficulty parameter to stabilize the rate at which new blocks could be added, so creating the foundation for Bitcoin, the first ever cryptocurrency. Nakamoto, personally, reputedly owns 1 million bitcoins, which, even after the massive crash of two-thirds value crash last year, today's trading rate, because I just looked it up, would be worth around $15 billion. But Satoshi Nakamoto has never sold a single bitcoin, which is evidence on some people's in some people's minds that Satoshi Nakamoto doesn't exist. But anyway, I won't go any further into that because my nerd meter needle is already quivering into the red zone. Now, at first, this difficulty parameter, I know this from slightly almost personal experience, this difficulty parameter basically, which is basically solving complex calculations in a process known as mining. This could be done on a high-end home computer. My older son got into this. He told me recently he got into Bitcoin mining in the 2010s, I think it was. But by the time he'd got into crypto mining, he found that he was spending as much on upgrading the hardware and on huge energy bills as he was making mining Bitcoins. So quite sensibly, in my opinion, he threw in the towel. The energy costs of Bitcoin mining today are equivalent to entire countries. The appeal, of course, of blockchains was that you could have a money system that wasn't controlled by central banks, who a lot of people, you know, wrongly blame for the 2008 financial crash. This led to a sort of euphoric techno-libertarian idealism as people imagined a form of open or free capitalism without the fat cat banks in charge, and by extension without states in charge. And this paved the way for the subsequent rise of cryptocurrencies, initially as a way to buy and sell goods and services without using the state fiat currencies. But as readers of Marx's Capital will know very well, a currency isn't just a handy way to buy and sell stuff, like a step up from simple barter. It also becomes a commodity in its own right. And commodity trading in cryptos rapidly came to eclipse their use as liquid currencies. When the price of gold, for example, keeps rocketing and plunging almost by the day, you can't realistically buy your household groceries in gold. For this reason, some people say that cryptocurrencies never really were serious currencies. Not only are they volatile, they're expensive to buy because you have to go through intermediaries who obviously charge commission. And people hope that their value will go up, so they tend to hoard them instead of spending them. So reducing the volume and velocity in circulation, and thus throttling market transactions while driving up the currency value. If a cryptocurrency is not a viable currency but only a commodity, it becomes quite similar to the other thing that I want to talk about, the NFT. Now, this is quite a curious offshoot of blockchains, which is not to do with currencies at all, but to do with the world of art. Now, in one video on this that I watched, the commentator talks about the story of Titus and Vespasian. I don't know how many people here know this story about the toilet denarius. Anyway, it's quite a good story, so I'll retell it. So Vespasian, you know, Roman emperor him, decides to impose a tax on public toilets to raise money for the imperial coffers. And his son Titus complains bitterly that this sort of carry-on is wholly unworthy of a respectable Roman emperor, at which the more pragmatic Vespasian famously holds up a coin and says, "Does this smell?" Well, the answer, of course, is that it doesn't smell of anything. It doesn't have its history imprinted into it. It's exactly like any coin that has not been earned from a public pissoir. It's unknowable, it's untrackable, it's entirely interchangeable with any other like coin, or in the lingo, it's fungible. This is from the Latin fungi, meaning function, not mushrooms. Now, blockchain elements are not fungible in that they are part of a chain, so they have a trackable history. So if you imagine a £5 note which automatically records the details of every single transaction it's ever been part of, though not, be it noted, the identity of those making the transactions, who can remain anonymous. So a trackable, recorded unit of currency that records its transactions, that's non-fungible. That's what makes it unique. Now, an essential requirement of an artwork for it to have any tradable value is also that it must be verifiably unique and not some photocopy knockoff. I mean, that's not the only requirement of an artwork. Obviously, you know, the fact that it might be give artistic or aesthetic pleasure might be a requirement, but these other requirements got forgotten when crypto enthusiasts went to town on the non-fungible uniqueness aspect and started trading in these hard to even know what to call them. Products is really the wrong word, isn't it? But anyway, in these virtual items, started trading in them in just about anything. From, it didn't matter what it was, almost. It could be a scribble. It could be a, you know, it could be a bit of video. It could be a snapshot. It didn't really matter. It was, it certainly didn't matter about artistic merit. What mattered was its provenance, and pedigree was written in stone, as recorded in a blockchain. And it caught on. Last year, 2021, it went ridiculous. The years before that, nobody had taken NFT seriously. It's just something that caught fire in 2021 as people started buying NFTs. Other people saw that people were buying NFTs and thought, well, shit, if they're buying NFTs, it must be good business, so I'd better buy NFTs too. And NFT trading globally rocketed to $40 billion in 2021, which is incredible when you consider that the global trade in fine arts, actual real sculptures, paintings, old masters, you name it, was only $50 billion. So internet doodles, video clips, crappy cartoons of bored rabbits, etc. were being treated like Titians and Leonardos. One digital collage sold last year at Christie's for $69 million. It's basically a great big square where somebody stuck a bunch of cut out photos from magazines, stuck them all together on a massive collage. Doesn't even look like anything from a distance, $69 million. And while we're at it, the promise of uniqueness also attracted scammers and scammers do things like pretend to have a new art collection to sell, and then you just disappear with the money. This is called a rug pull, by the way. There was one that's reported in today's Guardian about the Squid Game. There was a squid scam. People were encouraged to put money into this new Squid Game currency coin, don't know what it was, and after a few weeks the organisers just did a rug pull and disappeared with $3 million. Bored Bonnies was a $25 million scam. In fact, some experts think that 90% of the NFT market was just scams, which is a weird parallel to the 90% that the NFT market value crashed late last year. The situation now is that most NFTs are unsellable. And according to a Guardian story in December, are now being repurposed as tax write-offs via a new financial fire sale service called, wait for it, Unsellable. Meanwhile, one NFT company has been hit by a class action lawsuit claiming it had unrealistically hyped the value of its so-called goods and citing as co-defendants NFT endorsement advocates like Justin Bieber, Paris Hilton and Madonna. But all this hasn't stopped Nike, Gucci and other companies from investing in NFTs for the much vaunted metaverse. This ambitious project by Mark Zuckerberg and Meta, which is supposedly the next big thing, and it's too big a subject for this talk and really requires a separate talk. And the NFT disaster didn't stop Donald Trump in December from launching a collection of his own NFTs, which, if you recall the story, was a tasteful collection of picture cards of himself dressed as an astronaut, a cowboy, a superhero, and other things. He launched these as collectible NFTs in one of the most cringeworthy launches of anything I think I've seen in a long time. And I'm really quite sad to report that it sold out in a day. Obviously, I guess, to Trump supporters. Somebody is late. I just have to let them in. Okay. That's proper late, isn't it? Right. Okay. Back to cryptos. Well, in the light of everything I've said, with what Boris Johnson memorably described as Captain Hindsight, I think we can all now see that the crypto bubble was bound to burst. But it wasn't so obvious to all those busily blowing air into it. And meanwhile, politicians and legislators had dropped the ball on crypto, or take the word of the commentators, to be more accurate, they never picked it up in the first place. So a big complaint by a lot of commentators is that legislators have failed to take this seriously. They seem not to have grasped that an unlicensed and unregulated crypto exchange, which prints its own money as the exchange currency, is basically a money laundering scheme and a gift to organised crime. State legislatures and politicians didn't seem to appreciate that. Being decentralised, these exchanges offered no way to get your money back in the event of a scam, i.e., buy my product and I just might create it, or maybe not. And if I don't, well, sorry, there's no central authority that you can appeal to. Plus, the crypto transactions are irreversible, so you can't just phone the bank and get them to cancel the order. It's been done, and that's just too late. And don't think that it's just suckers that fall for these things. Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, lost $70,000 through one of these crypto scams. And governments seem unaware of the vast potential for Ponzi schemes, where anyone can create any new currency, like I just created Bollocks Coin, just by announcing an ICO, an initial coin offering, and then sitting back and waiting for the money to roll in. Hopefully. Well, of course it's not real money. I mean, what does real even mean in the world of crypto? And in any case, as is often pointed out, we all use government fiat currencies that aren't really, real either. But a computer scientist called Jackson Palmer, who once created a cryptocurrency for a joke, just to make a dig at Elon Musk. he thought it would be a joke and it would be forgotten in a few days. In fact, what happened was that his cryptocurrency, Dogecoin, caught on. And people bought into it, partly because Elon Musk himself took it seriously. He even called himself the Doge Farmer until Dogecoin in 2021 was valued at $80 billion, one of the four largest cryptocurrencies around. What did Jackson Palmer, who had done this for a joke, conclude about all this? He says, "That's when it really soured for me, like this joke isn't funny anymore." He also said, and he further says, this is why crypto won't die. It doesn't matter that these tokens don't work as currencies or that they have no intrinsic value. Crypto exchanges and shills don't care what they're selling as long as they can convince people to buy it. The cartel of exchanges who have a big incentive to keep people making as many trades as possible because that's their business model. They've built an online casino, and lawmakers are essentially asleep at the wheel and have been for the last decade. There's nothing stopping the same people who are declaring bankruptcy today launching something new a year or 2 years from now that does the same thing, extracting more money from the same people because they don't know that it's just the same crypto grift. Pretty harsh words. But governments, it turns out, could have easily adopted a semi-technical solution to tame this Wild West had they been so inclined. Blocks have a fixed 1 megabyte capacity, meaning that global crypto growth rates have a severe restriction. They're limited to 3 to 6 transactions a second. If anybody's wondering about this, I can give you a link where this is explained in quite a lot of detail. What this means is anyone could actually easily crash a cryptocurrency by overloading the exchange processing system with a fairly small amount of money. $1 million is cited. So it would work a bit like a denial of service attack. And if pressed, governments probably, governments could have done that if they wanted to. But in fact, with their sort of hands-off view, they take the view of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. If you invest in crypto and lose all your money, it's your own fault. But except that even governments, including the UK, seem bedazzled by the promised growth potential of crypto. Rishi Sunak in December announced that he wanted to make crypto part of the home financial activities. What's going to happen in the future is that the apostles of the blockchain have got the World Wide Web in their sights next. You know, it's not fair, they say, that the internet used to be free virgin prairie and forest for anybody to roam in, and now it's all controlled by the big four: Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Facebook. How much better it would be to decentralize the whole thing, allowing content producers like musicians and video makers and what have you to get direct payments for their work instead of all the money going to intermediaries like Spotify. Well, how can you decentralise the web and make sure the money goes where it's supposed to? Easy, the blockchain, they say. Now, at this point, people are deciding that enough is enough. In June last year, 1,500 computer scientists wrote to Congress in the US calling for more regulation over crypto trading. I quote, "The catastrophes and externalities related to blockchain technologies and crypto asset investments are neither isolated, nor are they the growing pains of a nascent technology. They are the inevitable outcomes of a tech that is not built for purpose and will remain forever unsuitable as a foundation for large-scale economic activity." So that's the negative. But to quote Andreessen Horowitz, which is a Silicon Valley venture capital company which is investing around $8 billion in Web3, they dismiss such critics as throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They argue that this it's only like the early internet and the dot-com bubble. You're bound to see a few early reversals before the market matures. Well, but the difference, arguably, is that the early internet had a clear use and value. But that's not the case with blockchains and crypto, because they're basically doing virtual versions of things that we can already do anyway in the capitalist system, using just ordinary fiat currencies and ordinary accounting and ledger techniques. So they're not actually necessary. And also they mainly, so the critics argue, don't do what they claim. For instance, it's actually not true that you can't interfere with a blockchain record. The cryptocurrency Ethereum, their own programmers actually did interfere with their blockchain after a massive theft. They went back and altered the records to remove the theft to fix it. So you can do it. You need 51% of the owners of the members of the blockchain in order to agree to do it, but 51% of the owners of Bitcoin is just three companies. So it's really not as hard to interfere with these things as people make out. But meanwhile, back to these advocates for Web3 who are so keen to decentralize the web away from the big four. Funnily enough, this the Andreessen Horowitz is the same company that backs and sits on the boards of the big four that they're supposedly planning to defenestrate. So what's really going on is centralization of the technical systems, but not decentralization of the money and power. They stay firmly centralized in the hands of the rich. So all Web3 will really do if it comes in is to introduce blockchain tokens as a way to make you and me pay for what was previously free, as well as adding a new layer of financialization that will encourage new speculator bubbles. Okay, so I'm approaching the end, you'll be relieved to hear, but before I finish, I'd like to note a tangential comment made by Jemima Kelly in the Financial Times podcast series Skeptic's Guide to Crypto, which is well worth a listen, full of interesting insights, some of which I've related here. In the final episode, she goes, I think, slightly too far in discussing the idea of crypto as cult, with crypto enthusiasts behaving like cult members who only see what they want to see and discount contradictory evidence as either irrelevant or faked. There may be crypto enthusiasts who are like that, but I think she's rather over-egging the pudding. And in fact, this notion of cultism itself sails a bit too close to cultism, because it starts to sound a bit like, if you don't think like I think, i.e. like Financial Times capitalist normal journalist think, you must be a gargling nutter in need of psychiatric help. But what she does do that's interesting is she talks about how cults develop a language of, quote, thought-terminating cliches, which are sort of easily little cliches, little sound bites that you can bandy about, they're designed to shut down opposition. She cites QAnon's Trust the Plan, or I did my research, or do your research. If any of you have sort of had any discussions with, you know, conspiracy theorists or people of that sort of mindset, you've probably heard them say, do your research. It's when, while I heard Jemima Kelly saying this, the sort of shiver went up my back as I thought, yeah, that rings well. I can recall people saying exactly that. Another thought-terminating cliche is, don't let yourself be ruled by fear. And still another is, don't listen to the SPs. SPs is suppressive persons. So it's a kind of passive-aggressive thought-terminating cliche that makes you the bad guy for disagreeing with them. It's because you're a suppressive person and you want them to feel bad. So, okay, so when you hear such terms, see if you can remember the phrase thought terminating cliche. I think it's a cracker. Okay, so briefly then, what's the future of crypto? Well, it looks like increased government regulation is pretty inevitable now that states are starting to cotton on to what's going on. Some people have got stupendously rich off crypto. Some have literally died trying, like the people who jumped off bridges in South Korea after being ruined in the Terra Luna crash. But crypto is not going to disappear just because of a global crash. Jackson Palmer, who I mentioned earlier, puts it this way. He says, asking if the crash will kill crypto is like asking if people losing money in Las Vegas will kill Las Vegas. So socialists have got nothing much to learn from this, aside from maybe filling in a few blanks and humouring my nerdy interests. Capitalism's always going to have its scams and its get-rich-quick schemes, regardless of crypto. But it does kind of show up the desperation that people have to escape from capitalism, thinking that crypto might be a way out for them. And there's something quite poignant about that. But as YouTube economist Gary Stevenson puts it, I like to quote him because I think he puts things well. I'll paraphrase. He says, there are no shortcuts to wealth. Sadly, the best way to get rich is to start rich. If you can't do that, then your best bet is probably to buy a house if you can. I know it's hard. I know it's not what you want to hear. But the system is stacked against you and there's nothing else you can do. Except, we socialists know, abolish capitalism, of course. But that's a whole other discussion. So for now, thank you for your attention.